Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of The Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Zitkala Shaw, who went by the name Gertrude Simmons Bonin. Zitkala Shaw was a member of the Yankton Dakota, also known as Sioux Tribe. An accomplished violinist, writer, and activist, she co-founded the National Council of American Indians, lobbied Congress to pass the Indian Citizenship Act, and wrote articles for The Atlantic and Harper's, as well as two books and an opera. We're joined today by scholar Dr. P. J. Hafen. Please see the show notes for Dr. Hafen's bio. Dr. Hafen is interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
All right, Dr. Hafen, thank you very much for being on this episode of Nation Writers with me. I want to start with, could you just tell me a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to this past pandemic?
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you. I'm speaking to you from the land of the Southern Paiutes. I'm a guest here. I have lived here for almost 30 years. I taught at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and worked in American Indian literature as I recently retired. My ancestral home is the Taos Pueblo in New Mexico. And in the pandemic, for one thing, I sorted my father's papers. That was kind of interesting, legal work. And thanks to technology, I've been doing several Zoom interviews about Gertrude Bonin due to her political participation. The suffragettes seem to have claimed her, and she was involved in that. So the centennial of the suffrage movement is important, but of course it affected American Indians quite differently than it did the ability of women to vote.
So you mentioned that Gertrude Bonin, and she also, her another name for is Zitkala Shaw, right? Am I saying that
correctly? Yes. Yeah.
Could you just talk a little bit about what name she preferred, or if she preferred both, or sort of, you know, in different settings, was it a different name that she went with? Or I don't know, it was always a fascinating aspect of her life to me, the dual name part of it.
It is, and I think there's a lot of self-recognition that comes with her renaming. She was born Gertrude Simmons in 1876, which is the same year as Battle of the Greasy Grass or the Battle of Little Bighorn. But the Yanktons had made a treaty early on with the United States. So she's in a little bit different situation than a lot of the Sioux tribes. Because of that, she, as a young woman, named herself Zitkala Shaw, which means redbird, but it's in Lakota. And by all probability, she grew up speaking Nakota, which is the language of the Yankton Sioux, but she wrote in Dakota, which makes sense because the Bible was first translated into Dakota. So that would have been her language of literacy. But anyway, as a young woman, she gave herself that name, Redbird. And for her creative writings around that young age, her early 20s and so forth, she used Zitkala Shaw. And she continued to use it, but eventually, as she married Raymond Bonin, she used Gertrude Bonin in her later writings much more, seemed to have dropped the Zitkala Shaw.
That's interesting. You mentioned as well the multiple languages that she wrote in. And that's one thing that fascinated me was, I mean, her ability to write in English, but then also her native, you said it was a Lakota language?
Her writings that I've seen are in Dakota.
Dakota, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
If you know, perhaps was there like a difference in her writing that you could tell based on the language she used, if that makes sense? Like, would the language affect her writing in any way?
Yes, she... In the early 1900s, between the time she left teaching at Carlisle Industrial School, she went to Boston to study music, and then she went back to the reservation to collect stories. And as far as we can tell, she wrote those stories in their original language, Dakota. And there is an example in Dreams and Thunder stories, poems in the Sundance Opera, of a story that she wrote in Dakota. And then I had the good fortune to meet Gary Cavender, who did a pretty literal translation. And then you compare that to the story that she wrote out of the original script. And it's interesting to see how she had a literary sense to shape the story, to shape the sentences, instead of just doing a literal translation.
Yeah, that's a interesting point, because that's, you know, without that literary sense, that's when, you know, the phrase lost in translation comes about, right? Like,
right.
It's a special sort of, I don't know, instinct to have, maybe. Obviously, she practiced at it too, but, and what do you think that does for a people, or her people, to be able to translate that work into, a different language, and then to perhaps reach a wider audience? What do you think that sort of action does for, people's stories and their history?
Well, I think it's really important, coming from an oral tradition, to be able to record those stories clearly, right. But to also see her voice in it. There's a lot of her, because she's a product of her age, and she trends toward sentimentality and drama a little bit.
Could you expand on that a little bit? You said a lot of her voice in those translations and in her writing. If you could characterize her writing voice, how would you describe it?
It's very sentimental. It goes for the heart.
Yeah.
But it goes for the heart with a purpose. Hmm. Like, one of her most melodramatic stories is The Soft-Hearted Sioux, about the young man who goes away to boarding school education. He comes home and he can't provide for his family. And you think, okay, that's basis of a good story. But then it goes on. He goes to a ranch and he's going to steal a cow. And in the process of doing so, he kills the rancher. And it just keeps going on, and it gets more and more dramatic. And when he gets home, he finds his grandfather is dead, and he has to pay the consequences of his crime. So the plot itself is quite melodramatic. But what she's saying is, look at what's happened to our people. They're starving. There's no way to provide for them, which leads us to commit acts that we would not normally commit, that violate our standards as a community. And it still is a terrible situation. So she's appealing to the sense of sympathy and emotion, to say, look at this injustice. What can we do to resolve it?
Yeah, I just read that story this morning, so it's fresh in fresh in my mind as well. Yeah.
Did I get the details right?
Yeah. Nailed it. But no, I noticed that too, as I've been reading her work. I like how you phrased it, sentimental, but with a purpose, and tugging at the reader's heartstrings to make them realize something that they might not be aware of.
Right.
I also found, as I was reading it, I was right there in the middle of the story, the description, her descriptions of the surrounding world are spot on, or not spot on, but make me feel like I'm there. And so I can definitely tell, I think, the nature and the, the natural world, and then against the civilized world, if you will, which she talks about, quote unquote civilized world. No one can see my quotes. I've read American Indian stories so far. But I just sensed a lot of the tension that she felt within herself comes through in her writing too, I think, between the world she was born into, and then, once she goes to the boarding school, she starts the path of sort of entering that the as she says, the pale-faced world.
Right.
And so I don't know if you could speak to that tension that seemed to be a really driving force in writing, and just in her life, it seemed to me as well, based on what she did after boarding school and in between and all that.
Well, I think you're right. I think that the early writings really show a binary the American Indian stories, the incidents in her childhood life, she presents a very Edenic world.
Mm, yeah.
And I used to always ask my students, how do you feel when she talks about those pale faces? You know, and she's able to insult you without insulting you.
Yeah.
By referring to the pale faces and the things that they have done. Because she sets up her argument, and again, she's appealing to the emotion. And look at this young girl who's so innocent and free and carefree, roaming across the plains. And if you look at those stories carefully, you see that she's presenting an argument that, and remember, this is 1900s. She's presenting an argument that Indians are civilized. She learns proper behavior from her mother. She learns how to respect visitors. She learns how to respect the earth. She learns how to respect stories. And she presents a situation which shows that young Native children are socialized and are civilized and have values, which is opposed to the savage imagery that's still prevalent in a lot of popular literature and culture of the time. So she goes from this innocence to along, and she uses such great metaphors too about riding on the rails and hearing the whining of the telegraph poles and so forth.
The iron horse.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, she gets into the situation where her hair is cut off. I mean, that's such an assault, a person assault to her being, and where she's confined and can't speak her traditional language and has to learn things that are quite foreign to her. And she sees death in the boarding school and has to cope with that. And so, yeah, she said it, she's echoing the savage civilized binary, but she's flipping it by saying, who's the savage and who is civilized? Who's behaving well and who's behaving poorly in this boarding school situation? It's really quite remarkable.
Yeah. And she flips that quite pretty stark terms, you know, and it doesn't hold anything back.
Right.
Which I think is pretty brave to do at that time. And correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but American Indian Stories was kind of it kind of reads like a memoir-ish now, but when it was first released as sort of different articles in different newspapers, right? Am I getting that right? Or magazines?
Magazines, yeah. Atlantic Monthly.
Atlantic, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And that brings me, I wanted to talk a little bit about her prolificness as a writer. She has a lot of work out there, a lot of articles, essays, poetry, these sort of like in American Indian Stories. I don't know if you would call them little vignettes, kind of autobiographical. Some of them not, some of them just short stories. But I don't know, that to me as a writer is impressive, the ability to write in different forms and to do it so often. I don't know if you could speak to that. And especially at a time when women, especially Native women, weren't necessarily as prevalent in that sphere.
Well, Native people in general were not prevalent writers in the 1900s. I think you have to go back to her oratory winning speech when she graduates from Earlham and see that she speaks with high oratory, you know, a high rhetoric, and she appeals for justice. And that's consistent through her whole life, all of her writings. And so there are a couple of observations I would make. One is that literary genres are a Western European construct. She is telling a good story, whether it's in fiction or memoir or expository writing. She is telling a story to meet her purpose or even poetry. And that purpose is consistent throughout her life, and that is for justice for Native peoples. And so, yes, she's really prolific early on. She does all these magazine publications, and she publishes the little book, Old Indian Legends, which is published by McGinn and illustrated by the Winnebago artist Angela DeCora. And part of it is an appeal to the exotic. People want to know about American Indians through their own voices, know their stories. And so there's a certain quaintness going on, but she never strays from those objectives about justice. All this happens really quickly. And then she gets married and you don't hear from her again in print for another 12 years or so. But in reality, she continued writing. And I had the good fortune to find those unpublished stories. And those are in Dreams and Thunder. Those are the stories that are there. And they're traditional Sioux stories. And I feel very fortunate to be part of that recovery effort to find her voice. And then when she comes back, she gets involved with the Society of American Indians. And she submits some articles for publication. I think the first one is about her work among the Utes, because she and her husband were living in Utah and working with the Uinta Ouray Utes. They're employees of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so it's a narrative about her work there. But even in that narrative, she's saying things like, look at how they tried to cheat Chipita out of her what was deserved for her, and look how they're treating the Utes. And you know, there's this real sense of indignation. And if you've ever been around Sioux women, you know that they're not going to be quieted. She had a very strong and fierce personality, and it led her into conflict sometimes with others. It reminds me of a woman I know from a seminar at the Newberry who wrote, the seminar was about feminism and Native peoples. And the title of her paper was, I Never Knew I Was Oppressed Until a Feminist Told Me, because of the power of women in Native societies. Hmm. So I think it's quite natural that she would, I don't think she ever lacked confidence.
Yeah. Even as the little girl, it seems, through the rest of her life, she had that.
Yeah. And she's shaping those memoirs. She's really shaping. She's telling you what she wants you to hear. Mm. And how she presents herself and how she presents her mother and her relationship with her mother. All of those things she's shaping to make her points.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned her work with the
Society of American Indians.
Yeah. Could you speak a little bit about that and what that work was and, you know, what she was involved in during that time in her life?
Sure. First of all, she hated living in Utah. Mm-hmm. She just hated it. And she wrote consistently to friends in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and to the Catholic priests that she entrusted. She and her husband became Catholics. And that's another thing. You know, she writes this marvelous essay in American Indian Story. It's called Why I Am a Pagan. And later it's called The Great Spirit. And a lot of people look to that as an affirmation of indigenous beliefs. But she was a Catholic. She and her husband joined the Catholic Church and remained somewhat consistent Catholics. But, you know, and she hated living in Utah. And she said, there are no Christians here. You need to come make a Catholic church. And she said terrible things about the Utes and their bear dances and the things that they were doing. Of course, she didn't believe that the Mormons out there were Christians, and she didn't like the Episcopalians. So she was constantly appealing to the Catholic priests that she knew to come and make a Catholic church in Utah. And there were other political things going on. Her son wasn't accepted by the local community, and she got in conflict with some of the Bureau people, and they killed their donkey. And, you know, a lot of things like that were in the letters that aren't even really published anywhere. But I think they're a really important part of her biography, because she wants to get out of Utah. She would like to go back to South Dakota, but there's no employment to go back and to be with the Yankton. And then her old fiance, Carlos Montezuma, was involved in the organizing of the Society of American Indians, and he invites her. And she doesn't go to the first meeting, which is in Columbus, Ohio, in 1911, but she starts to participate after that. And she submits these articles, and eventually she gets involved. She becomes the secretary of the organization. And she pushes Arthur Parker out to become editor of the magazine. And, you know, that's where a lot of those mid-teen writings, 19-teens, come from, her editorship. And because of the people that she meets there, she starts giving speeches. And she starts promoting her causes. And, of course, one of those causes is for citizenship for returning soldiers. 12,000 American Indians fight in World War I without the benefit of American Indian citizenship.
Wow.
And so she argues that they deserve equal rights, and that's where she gets caught up in the suffrage movement.
Okay, yeah. That was going to be my question, as you mentioned that earlier in our discussion. Yeah, how they kind of, that suffrage movement has kind of, or maybe you could speak to it as it was happening, was she as welcomed as she is now in the suffrage movement, if that makes sense? Like during her time, was there any pushback to her joining it or anything like that that you're aware of?
Well, I wish Catherine Cahill were here to answer your questions, because she's written a book about it. But I think it was easier for the white society of women suffragettes to accept Gertrude Bonnet, because she has this exotic air about her, and she has a certain performativity. When she gives her speeches, she wears her traditional regalia. And people love that. You know, they're drawn to the exotic, whereas their blatant racism toward the African-American women who are trying to participate really comes through. So I think there was kind of a double standard in what was going on there. And of course, Gertrude Bonnet is not fighting for women's right to vote as much as all American Indians' right to vote, male and female. So I've been really amused by the Utah campaign. It's called Better Days, and they've done wonderful work about educating about suffrage and so forth. And they claim Gertrude because she lived those 12 years in Utah. But Utah is the last state in 1957 to give American Indians the right to vote. They're the first to give women the right to vote, but the last to give American Indians the right to vote. So the issues are quite complicated and overlapping and embedded in a whole bunch of other issues. So it's not as simple as just the suffrage movement. But Gertrude did know how to work an audience. And she knew how to appeal to her causes. And she did that well.
Hmm. Did she do a lot of speeches or, you know, performances in front of audiences?
Yes, she did.
Yeah. Yeah. She on the speaking circuit, if you will.
She was.
Yeah.
She was. She was affiliated with the General Federated Women's Clubs and got them to get an Indian committee, and she did. She worked the circuit.
Nice. That the, you know, performance makes me think. One thing I do want to ask you about and go into it in your book, Dreams and Thunder, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, your book, Dreams and Thunder, has selected poems and writings that you said, but a big part of it is the Sundance Opera, which researching the Kalisha was a fascinating subject to me. Again, kind of same in a way, translating that, like we were talking about the old Indian legends, translating that into a different, to present it to a different audience. So yeah, I don't know if you could speak to that a little bit about, you know, your process in putting that book together, and then also sort of just to tell us a little bit about the Sundance Opera from your perspective.
Well, the Sundance Opera is a wild thing. You know, she's stuck out there in Utah, and, you know, no TV, no radio, personal entertainment. She meets a music teacher. She was a musician. She played the violin. She played the piano.
That's right.
And they entertained each other in the evenings, kind of in a parlor way. And she met this music teacher named William Hansen. And I describe it as, let's do an opera. You know, like the Muppets go to Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
But
why not?
Yeah, why not? And they talked about doing an opera on the life of Chipita, who is the widow of Ouray, the Ute chief out there, and decided against that, and decided to do one on the Sundance. And this, it's fascinating. It's really, really fascinating. Structurally, first of all, I've been told that the Yanktons did not Sundance, but the Utes did.
Interesting.
Yeah. And they have their Sundance arena, and the opera is set up like a love triangle. They have the hero, whose name is Ohia, and that's the name of her son, and he pledges to Sundance. But then his competition for the girl is in the form of the evil Shoshone, because of the intertribal competitions between the Utes and the Shoshones. So you have this basic love triangle that's going on, but it's cast against the pledge of the Sundance. And there are some interesting set pieces. In a lot of ways, you know, opera is the plural of operas, because it uses all the arts together. It uses drama, uses theater, uses literature, uses music all together. And so I think what she was trying to do, along with William Hansen, is to elevate this traditional story to the heights of Western civilization. What better example of performance could there be than opera? It's going to be better than a novel. It's going to be better than a short story or whatever. So it has that performative element to it. And there are some really interesting things about some of the characters in there, because there's a trio of gossips, which is very tribal. You know, the value of gossiping and the value of storytelling. And so they set it up as three female singers singing this set piece. And then another minor character is the Heyoka, who in traditional societies is somebody who does everything backwards. And so he doesn't follow traditional norms, particularly traditional sexual norms.
Okay.
Does everything backwards. So you have these characters that are part of the social structure of these traditional tribal societies. And then you have the love triangle, and then you have it set with the Sundance. They have to go get the trees, and Ohia has to pledge himself to the Sundance and so forth. So, you know, those aspects of it are so interesting. And in the original performances, they have the libretto and the orchestration, and then they have big pauses, because they used local Utes to sing their traditional Sundance songs.
Oh, cool.
Now, keep in mind, the Sundance is forbidden legally as a pagan ritual. The government has said, you can't do this anymore.
And what, real quick, what time frame are we looking at here?
1912.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And so you'd say, okay. And then they go sing their songs. They go sing their songs on stage, because that performance venue is legal and acceptable. Yeah, so there are a lot of fascinating things about it. But then you get to the music, and have you ever heard of Nelson Eddy?
No.
Operetta? Very sentimental music, very unsophisticated, very simple in some ways.
Okay.
I mean, you think in 1912, Stravinsky's writing Petrushka and the Firebird and all of these really sophisticated things, and Prokofiev's writing symphonies and Tchaikovsky's done Swan Lake. And here you have these little little pieces that are sentimental and not very sophisticated. But I will say this, there was a group of students at Westminster College in Salt Lake City who in the, about 6 or 7 years ago, there were three siblings who researched the opera. And they were Navajo, and they were classically trained musicians. And so they staged selections from the opera. And it was fascinating. I was really lucky to be part of that. The soprano, Sarah Singer, and their name was Singer. The soprano, Sarah Singer, she's fantastic. And she took this music, which is, in my opinion, not great music, and made it something better than it was because of her performance. And they really gave life to the Sundance Opera. The opera was performed in Utah, and Utah has a great theater tradition, and people went to see it, and they liked it. And William Hansen went on to become a music professor at Brigham Young University. And in 1938, he revives it through a former student of his at the New York City Opera, and it got panned. It was totally panned by the critics. And he had removed virtually every aspect of Gertrude's participation in the composition. He'd claimed it as his own. And he had written another opera later, too, about the bear dance by the Utes. But Gertrude wasn't involved in that, and she passed away just a few months before it was performed in New York. That's kind of a long story, but it's got a life of its own.
And great to see that even in recent history, it's still being revived and done well, like you said. And I guess that's a good way to transition. Like, what about Gertrude's work? Like, do you think makes it so enduring? And why should listeners to our podcast go and read some of Zikola Shad's work today? What about it is impactful still?
Well, the boarding school narratives are one of a kind. She seems to be the first native writer to write without heavy editing and without a translator. It really is her own voice. And you can see that consistently through the writings throughout her life. That is her own voice. And the boarding school experiences are dramatic, and they cry out for social justice. And it's still an issue today. You know, they're finding bodies at boarding schools around. And the legacy of descendants of boarding school survivors persists. At the boarding school, you lose a generation of native speakers. And one of the reasons that Gertrude names herself, instead of being in a traditional naming ceremony back on the reservation, is because she's removed from that traditional tribal practice. So she has to do it for herself. And the boarding school narratives are enough. But then you look at the broader sense of what she's written, and it gets into kind of wonky policy stuff, which I think is very interesting. And it's in the last book that I edited. And for example, one of the essays in there is called Oklahoma's Poor Rich Indians. And it's about she and a group of people from the American Indian Defense Association went to Oklahoma because there was a lot of exploitation and grift going on. Especially among the Osage. And so it gives case studies of that. So a couple of years ago, there was a book called Killers of the Flower Moon, which you may have heard of. And now Martin Scorsese is making a movie about this. But you find the original document, the original reports that were presented before Congress in this, in her later writings.
Oh, interesting.
So, there's a lot of the issues that are current today are evident in her writings from the 1920s, when she's spending a lot of time giving speeches and testifying before Congress. Native issues had to be resolved by Congress. They weren't just local issues. They had to have hearings and, you know, be voted on and so forth. And so she and Raymond are consistent presenters before Congress of individual cases.
I think that kind of answers my next question, which would be if Zikla Shah were around today, how do you think she would be engaging with our current world? And I think, unfortunately, she'd be doing the same thing, right? Like writing and advocating and I don't know. How do you think she would be in today's world?
Oh, I think she'd be right in the thick of things, worried about murdered and missing Indigenous women, worried about land rights, water rights, the Keystone Project, I think she'd be right in the thick of those things. But I think another thing that is really important to know is that she was the spokesperson, but her husband did the legal work behind a lot of this. And somebody really needs to do a dissertation or a biography of him and to see how that all spins out. Because land rights issues, those are current.
Right.
And they're right in the thick of all of that legislation that is happening in the 1920s and the 1930s that set up the series of events with tribes and their abilities to make land claims.
Yeah. Do you see any literary lineage, if you will, of current writers who write in this similar vein, maybe not same style or voice, but any contemporary writers who, write with the same sort of, passion that Gertrude did and carry that lineage on today?
Well, two come to mind immediately. One is Winona LaDuke. Is very politically active and writes for Indian causes. And the other is Layli Long Soldier, who wrote the introduction to the version that you have of American Indian Stories.
Yeah.
And just last week, she gave a reading at the Folger Library, and she's writing poems based on Gertrude's writing. She sees herself as a Sioux woman, as a direct descendant, literary descendant of Gertrude Bonnet. And the poetry that she's writing that takes its inspiration from Gertrude's writing is just, it's fascinating and amazing.
Yeah, I'll have to keep an eye out for that then. I think you mentioned that last week as well as we were arranging all this. We did a program with Layli Long Soldier and Tanaya Winder and Mark Turcott last year. With the Norton Anthology of Native poets there.
And
They read their pieces from that. That was one of the programs that stuck with me. Just, speaking their truths and the poetry itself is just great. Definitely going to keep an eye out for Layli's new stuff coming out, especially after doing all this research.
Yeah, because it is directly related to her work with Gertrude Bonnet. And I'm so glad that she's doing it.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it sounds great. So we talked a little bit, about some other people, and I'm curious if you're willing to share what how you first encountered Zikla Shah's work and since that encounter, what her work and what her as a person has meant to you personally.
Thanks for asking that. And it's part of the reason I was asking you about Chicago, because I had a fellowship at the Newberry Library.
Oh, great. Yeah. We love the new book.
When I got the fellowship, my work at that time was mostly with contemporary American Indian literatures, but I needed a historical project. Remembered seeing at Brigham Young University the opera, the Sundance Opera. I thought, okay, I need to learn something more about that. And so I did a lot of work there at the Newberry because they have tremendous resources. But it took me back to Brigham Young University, and that's where I found the unpublished stories and the libretto to the opera. And then the long-term project of gathering her expository writing. I think Dreams and Thunder was published in 2001, and Help Indians Help Themselves was published in 2020. So, it was a long time coming, and I did a lot of other things in between. But I did a lot of research, a lot of archival research, like the things I was telling you about her experience in Utah. You know, that took a lot of archival research of correspondence and so forth. Mm-hmm. Brigham University was really great. Raymond studied to be a lawyer, but he never had a college degree and he never passed the bar. And so after a little spat with between the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, John Collier, and Gertrude, Collier said that only lawyers could represent tribes. And Raymond had all of this legal work that he could not submit.
Mm.
So he contractually engaged with a law firm that was headed by a guy named Ernest L. Wilkinson, who becomes primary in establishing Indian legal claims.
Mm.
And Wilkinson later becomes the president of BYU for $1 a year.
Wow.
Because of the first claim, which was settled by the three consolidated Ute tribes in the early 1950s. And of course, by then, Gertrude and Raymond had both passed away. And Wilkinson was concerned about keeping the legal lines straight. And so he just kept these boxes of all their papers. And that's where the stories were. And that's how they ended up at BYU. And what I didn't know until I did my research is that the government required the Utes to show what they were going to do with their settlement monies. And they started an education project, and they hired these college graduates to help them with adult education. And one of them was Robert Bennett, who was Oneida and became the first American Indian Commissioner of Indian Affairs in the 1960s. And one was Joe Sando, who was a Jemez Pueblo historian. And the other was my father.
Oh, wow.
Who received a degree in adult education. And that's why I was born among and raised among the Utes.
Hmm.
But I didn't know that that was the why and wherefore when I started on this project.
Wow. That's wild.
Yeah. So even though I'm not Sioux, I feel like I was in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like I have that literary heritage myself.
Yeah. I mean, the coincidence can only be coincidence for so long, right? That seems like too much of a full circle to, like you said, right place, right time. I like that.
Yeah. And I feel a great honor to have found her voice. You know, academic books don't make hardly any money. And I never keep it, and I always give it to a cause that I think that she would support.
Nice. Yeah, that's great, actually. Well, we're getting close to wrapping up. Do you have any favorite passages or poems of Gertrude's that I don't know if you'd like to read any aloud or?
When Gertrude and Raymond founded the Council of National Council of American Indians, it was the idea of getting tribes together to represent their rights before Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And in part of Help Indians Help Themselves is the Constitution that they wrote and submitted, and it's in the Congressional Record. And so let me just read the first two paragraphs from there. When in the course of human events, a civilized state asserts by virtue of an alleged right of discovery the power of preemption in an aboriginal territory, it assumes before the Great Spirit who rules over the destinies of mankind and under the law of nations an obligation for those whose possession it displaces, which neither emperors nor sovereign peoples may avoid. Wherefore, since the allegiance of the American Indian tribes subject to the sovereignty of the United States was secured by treaties between the United States and the said tribes whose aboriginal rights were guaranteed by the United States in treaties with the sovereignties of Great Britain, France, Spain, Mexico, Russia. And whereas it was by the virtue of those solemn treaty compacts which the Honorable Senate of the United States alone had power to ratify, that the constitutional rights of Indian inhabitants of the United States vested in them, now therefore in the exercise of the right of petition guaranteed by the First Amendment of the Constitution, the National Council of American Indians, on behalf of the Indian citizens of the United States, addresses this in petition to the Senate of the United States assembled for the redress of their grievances, setting forth and alleging the manifold wrongs that are being done them by the Congress and the government of the United States in violation of the terms and the spirit of the said treaties and the Constitution of the United States.
Woo. I like that. That's a great use of the, you know, phrases like when in the course of human events, and just that's, I love that. Just flipping it back on them.
Yeah, exactly. They're flipping the legal rhetoric and say, folks, you owe us.
Yeah, right. Yeah, past due.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Hafen. Could you, what was the name of that that you just read again?
It's
in case any of our listeners want to look it up and read it more.
Sure. It's from Help Indians Help Themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's the petition of the National Council of American Indians.
Okay. And just for my own curiosity, when was that written?
1926.
1926, yeah. I just want to thank you again for taking the time to, you know, coordinate this with me, and then taking time out of your day to talk with me. And I know I appreciate it a lot.
But yeah. Thank you for your interest. Thank you for your patience, Nate. It was really nice. Thank you for having thoughtful questions. You have a wonderful harvest feast. And
you as well. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The next episode will air in December. If you would like to learn more about the American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, come check it out in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.